pointless to say that this or that night was the worst of my life. I have so many bad nights to choose from that I've made none the champion. Still, that second night at sea stands in my memory as one of exceptional suffering, different from the frozen anxiety of the first night in being a more conventional sort of suffering, the broken-down kind consisting of weeping and sadness and spiritual pain, and different from later ones in that I still had the strength to appreciate fully what I felt. And that dreadful night was preceded by a dreadful evening. I noticed the presence of sharks around the lifeboat. The sun was beginning to pull the curtains on the day. It was a placid explosion of orange and red, a great chromatic symphony, a color canvas of supernatural proportions, truly a splendid Pacific sunset, quite wasted on me. The sharks were makos, swift, pointy-snouted predators with long, murderous teeth that protruded noticeably from their mouths. They were about 6 or 7 feet long. One was larger still. I watched them anxiously. The largest one came at the boat quickly, as if to attack, its dorsal fin rising out of the water by several inches, but it dipped below just before reaching us and glided underfoot with fearsome grace. It returned, not coming so close this time, then disappeared. The other sharks paid a longer visit, coming and going at different depths, some in plain sight at hand's reach below the surface of the water, others deeper down. There were other fish too, big and small, colorful, differently shaped. I might have considered them more closely had my attention not been drawn elsewhere. Orange Juice's head came into sight. She turned and brought her arm onto the tarpaulin in a motion that imitated exactly the way you or I would bring out an arm and place it on the back of the chair next to our own in a gesture of expansive relaxation. But such was clearly not her disposition. Bearing an expression profoundly sad and mournful, she began to look about, slowly turning her head from side to side. Instantly, the likeness of apes lost its amusing character. She had given birth at the zoo to two young ones, strapping males 5 and 8 years old, that were her and our pride. It was unmistakably these she had on her mind as she searched over the water, unintentionally mimicking what I had been doing these last 36 hours. She noticed me and expressed nothing about it. I was just another animal that had lost everything and was vowed to death. My mood plummeted. Then, with only a snarl for notice, the hyena went amok. It hadn't moved from its cramped quarters all day. It put its front legs on the zebra's side, reached over, and gathered a fold of skin in its jaws. It pulled roughly. A strip of hide came off the zebra's belly like gift wrap paper comes off a gift, in a smooth-edged swath, only silently, in the way of tearing skin, and with greater resistance. Immediately, blood poured forth like a river. Barking, snorting, and squealing, the zebra came to life to defend itself. It pushed on its front legs and reared its head in an attempt to bite the hyena, but the beast was out of reach. It shook its good hind leg, which did no more than explain the origin of the previous night's knocking. It was the hoof beating against the side of the boat. The zebra's attempts at self-preservation only whipped the hyena into a frenzy of snarling and biting. It made a gaping wound in the zebra's side. When it was no longer satisfied with the reach it had from behind the zebra, the hyena climbed onto its haunches. It started pulling out coils of intestines and other viscera. There was no order to what it was doing. It bit here, swallowed there, seemingly overwhelmed by the riches before it. After devouring half the liver, it started tugging on the whitish balloon-like stomach bag. But it was heavy, and with the zebra's haunches being higher than its belly and blood being slippery, The hyena started to slide into its victim. It plunged head and shoulders into the zebra's guts up to the knees of its front legs. It pushed itself out, only to slide back down. It finally settled in this position, half in, half out. The zebra was being eaten alive from the inside. It protested with diminishing vigor. Blood started coming out its nostrils. Once or twice it reared its head straight up, as if appealing to heaven. The abomination of the moment was perfectly expressed. Orange Juice did not view these doings indifferently. She raised herself to her full height on her bench. With her incongruously small legs and massive torso, she looked like a refrigerator on crooked wheels. But with her giant arms lifted in the air, she looked impressive. Their span was greater than her height. One hand hung over the water, the other reached across the width of the lifeboat nearly to the opposite side. She pulled back her lips, showing off enormous canines, and began to roar. It was a deep, powerful, huffing roar, amazing for an animal normally as silent as a giraffe. The hyena was as startled as I was by the outburst. It cringed and retreated. But not for long. After an intense stare at Orange Juice, the hairs on its neck and shoulders stood up and its tail rose straight in the air. It climbed back onto the dying zebra. There, blood dripping from its mouth, it responded to Orange Juice in kind with a higher-pitched roar. The two animals were 3 feet apart, wide open jaws directly facing. They put all their energies into their cries, their bodies shaking with the effort. I could see deep down the hyena's throat. The Pacific air, which until a minute before had been carrying the whistling and whispering of the sea, a natural melody I would have called soothing had the circumstances been happier, was all at once filled with this appalling noise, like the fury of an all-out battle, with the ear-splitting firing of guns and cannons and the thunderous blasts of bombs. The hyena's roar filled the higher range of what my ears could hear. Orange Juice's bass roar filled the lower range, and somewhere in between, I could hear the cries of the helpless zebra. My ears were full. Nothing more, not one more sound, could push into them and be registered. I began to tremble uncontrollably. I was convinced the hyena was going to lunge at Orange Juice. I could not imagine that matters could get worse. But they did. The zebra snorted some of its blood overboard. Seconds later, there was a hard knock against the boat, followed by another. The water began to churn around us with sharks. They were searching for the source of the blood, for the food so close at hand. Their tail fins flashed out of the water, their heads swung out. The boat was hit repeatedly. I was not afraid we would capsize. I thought the sharks would actually punch through the metal hull and sink us. With every bang, the animals jumped up and looked alarmed, but they were not to be distracted from their main business of roaring in each other's faces. I was certain the shouting match would turn physical. Instead, it broke off abruptly after a few minutes. Orange Juice, with huffs and lip-smacking noises, turned away, and the hyena lowered its head and retreated behind the zebra's butchered body. The sharks, finding nothing, stopped knocking on the boat and eventually left. Silence fell at last. A foul and pungent smell, an earthy mix of rust and excrement, hung in the air. There was blood everywhere, coagulating to a deep red crust. A single fly buzzed about, sounding to me like an alarm bell of insanity. No ship, nothing at all, had appeared on the horizon that day. And now the day was ending. When the sun slipped below the horizon, it was not only the day that died and the poor zebra, but my family as well. With that second sunset, disbelief gave way to pain and grief. They were dead. I could no longer deny it. What a thing to acknowledge in your heart. To lose a brother is to lose someone with whom you can share the experience of growing old, who is supposed to bring you a sister-in-law and nieces and nephews, creatures to people the tree of your life and give it new branches. To lose your father is to lose the one whose guidance and help you seek, who supports you like a tree trunk supports its branches. To lose your mother, well, that is like losing the sun above you. It is like losing... I'm sorry, I would rather not go on. I lay down on the tarpaulin and spent the whole night weeping and grieving, my face buried in my arms. The hyena spent a good part of the night eating. Chapter 47. The day broke, humid and overcast, with the wind warm and the sky a dense blanket of grey clouds that looked like bunched up, dirty cotton sheets. The sea had not changed. It heaved the lifeboat up and down in a regular motion. The zebra was still alive. I couldn't believe it. It had a 2-foot-wide hole in its body, a fistula like a freshly erupted volcano, spewed half-eaten organs glistening in the light or giving off a dull, dry shine, yet, in its strictly essential parts, it continued to pump with life, if weakly. Movement was confined to a tremor in the rear leg and an occasional blinking of the eyes. I was horrified. I had no idea a living being could sustain so much injury and go on living. The hyena was tense. It was not settling down to its night of rest despite the daylight. Perhaps it was a result of taking in so much food. Its stomach was grossly dilated. Orange Juice was in a dangerous mood too. She was fidgeting and showing her teeth. I stayed where I was, curled up near the prow. I was weak in body and in soul. I was afraid I would fall into the water if I tried to balance on the oar. The zebra was dead by noon. It was glassy-eyed, and had become perfectly indifferent to the hyena's occasional assaults. Violence broke out in the afternoon. Tension had risen to an unbearable level. The hyena was yipping. Orange Juice was grunting and making loud lip-smacking noises. All of a sudden, their complaining fused and shot up to top volume. The hyena jumped over the remains of the zebra and made for Orange Juice. I believe I've made clear the menace of a hyena. It was certainly so clear in my mind that I gave up on Orange Juice's life before she even had a chance to defend it. I underestimated her. I underestimated her grit. She thumped the beast on the head. It was something shocking. It made my heart melt with love and admiration and fear. Did I mention she was a former pet, callously discarded by her Indonesian owners? Her story was like that of every inappropriate pet. It goes something like this. The pet is bought when it is small and cute. It gives much amusement to its owners. Then it grows in size and in appetite. It reveals itself incapable of being house-trained. Its increasing strength makes it harder to handle. One day, the maid pulls the sheet from its nest because she has decided to wash it, or the son jokingly pinches a morsel of food from its hands. Over some such seemingly small matter, the pet flashes its teeth in anger, and the family is frightened. The very next day, the pet finds itself bouncing at the back of the family jeep in the company of its human brothers and sisters. A jungle is entered. Everyone in the vehicle finds it a strange and formidable place. A clearing is come to. It is briefly explored. All of a sudden, The jeep roars to life and its wheels kick up dirt, and the pet sees all the ones it has known and loved looking at it from the back window as the jeep speeds up. It has been left behind. The pet does not understand. It is as unprepared for this jungle as its human siblings are. It waits around for their return, trying to quell the panic rising in it. They do not return. The sun sets. Quickly it becomes depressed and gives up on life. It dies of hunger and exposure in the next few days. Or is attacked by dogs. Orange Juice could have been one of these forlorn pets. Instead, she ended up at the Pondicherry Zoo. She remained gentle and unaggressive her whole life. I have memories from when I was a child of her never-ending arms surrounding me, her fingers, each as long as my whole hand, picking at my hair. She was a young female practicing her maternal skills. As she matured into her full, wild self, I observed her at a distance. I thought I knew her so well that I could predict her every move. I thought I knew not only her habits, but also her limits. This display of ferocity, of savage courage, made me realize that I was wrong. All my life, I had known only a part of her. She thumped the beast on the head. And what a thump it was! The beast's head hit the bench it had just reached, making such a sharp noise, besides splaying its front legs flat out, that I thought surely either the bench or its jaw or both must break. The hyena was up again in an instant, every hair on its body as erect as the hairs on my head, but its hostility wasn't quite so kinetic now. It withdrew. I exulted. Orange Juice's stirring defense brought a glow to my heart. It didn't last long. An adult female orangutan cannot defeat an adult male spotted hyena. That is the plain empirical truth. Let it become known among zoologists. Had Orange Juice been a male, had she loomed as large on the scales as she did in my heart, it might have been another matter. But portly and overfed though she was from living in the comfort of a zoo, even so she tipped the scales at barely 110 pounds. Female orangutans are half the size of males. But it is not simply a question of weight and brute strength. Orange Juice was far from defenseless. What it came down to is attitude and knowledge. What does a fruit eater know about killing? Where would it learn where to bite, how hard, for how long? An orangutan may be taller, may have very strong and agile arms and long canines, but if it does not know how to use these as weapons, they are of little use. The hyena, with only its jaws, will overcome the ape because it knows what it wants and how to get it. The hyena came back. It jumped on the bench and caught Orange Juice at the wrist before she could strike. Orange Juice hit the hyena on the head with her other arm, but the blow only made the beast snarl viciously. She made to bite, but the hyena moved faster. Alas, Orange Juice's defense lacked precision and coherence. Her fear was something useless that only hampered her. The hyena let go of her wrist and expertly got to her throat. Dumb with pain and horror, I watched as Orange Juice thumped the hyena ineffectually and pulled at its hair while her throat was being squeezed by its jaws. To the end, she reminded me of us. Her eyes expressed fear in such a human-like way, as did her strained whimpers. She made an attempt to climb onto the tarpaulin. The hyena violently shook her. She fell off the bench to the bottom of the lifeboat, the hyena with her. I heard noises, but no longer saw anything. I was next. That much was clear to me. With some difficulty, I stood up. I could hardly see through the tears in my eyes. I was no longer crying because of my family or because of my impending death. I was far too numb to consider either. I was crying because I was exceedingly tired, and it was time to get dressed. I advanced over the tarpaulin. Though tautly stretched at the end of the boat, it sagged a little in the middle. It made for 3 or 4 toilsome, bouncy steps, and I had to reach over the net and the rolled-up tarpaulin, and these efforts in a lifeboat that was constantly rolling. In the condition I was in, it felt like a great trek. When I laid my foot on the middle cross bench, its hardness had an invigorating effect on me, as if I had just stepped on solid ground. I planted both my feet on the bench and enjoyed my firm stand. I was feeling dizzy, but since the capital moment of my life was coming up, this dizziness only added to my sense of frightened sublimity. I raised my hands to the level of my chest, the weapons I had against the hyena. It looked up at me. Its mouth was red. Orange juice lay next to it, against the dead zebra. Her arms were spread wide open, and her short legs were folded together and slightly turned to one side. She looked like a Simeon Christ on the cross, except for her head. She was beheaded. The neck wound was still bleeding. It was a sight horrible to the eyes and killing to the spirit. Just before throwing myself upon the hyena, to collect myself before the final struggle, I looked down. Between my feet, under the bench, I beheld Richard Barker's head. It was gigantic. It looked the size of the planet Jupiter to my dazed senses. His paws were like volumes of Encyclopedia Britannica. I made my way back to the bow and collapsed. I spent the night in a state of delirium. I kept thinking I had slept and was awaking after dreaming of a tiger. Chapter 48. Richard Barker was so named because of a clerical error. A panther was terrorizing the Khulna district of Bangladesh, just outside the Sundarbans. It had recently carried off a little girl. All that was found of her was a tiny hand with a henna pattern on the palm and a few plastic bangles. She was the 7th person killed in 2 months by the marauder. And it was growing bolder. The previous victim was a man who had been attacked in broad daylight in his field. The beast dragged him off into the forest, where it ate a good part of his head, the flesh off his right leg, and all his innards. His corpse was found hanging in the fork of a tree. The villagers kept a watch nearby that night, hoping to surprise the panther and kill it, but it never appeared. The forest department hired a professional hunter. He set up a small, hidden platform in a tree near a river where 2 of the attacks had taken place. A goat was tied to a stake on the river's bank. The hunter waited several nights. He assumed the panther would be an old, wasted male with worn teeth, incapable of catching anything more difficult than a human. But it was a sleek tiger that stepped into the open one night. A female with a single cub. The goat bleated. Oddly, the cub, who looked to be about 3 months old, paid little attention to the goat. It raced to the water's edge, where it drank eagerly. Its mother followed suit. Of hunger and thirst, thirst is the greater imperative. Only once the tiger had quenched her thirst did she return to the goat to satisfy her hunger. The hunter had two rifles with him, one with real bullets, the other with immobilizing darts. This animal was not the man-eater, but so close to human habitation she might pose a threat to the villagers, especially as she was with cub. He picked up the gun with the darts. He fired as the tiger was about to fell the goat. The tiger reared up and snarled and raced away. But immobilizing darts don't bring on sleep gently like a good cup of tea. They knock out like a bottle of hard liquor straight up. A burst of activity on the animal's part makes it act all the faster. The hunter called his assistants on the radio. They found the tiger about 200 yards from the river. She was still conscious. Her back legs had given way, and her balance on her front legs was woozy. When the men got close, she tried to get away, but could not manage it. She turned on them, lifting a paw that was meant to kill. It only made her lose her balance. She collapsed, and the Pondicherry Zoo had 2 new tigers. The cub was found in a bush close by, meowing with fear. The hunter, whose name was Richard Parker, picked it up with his bare hands and, remembering how it had rushed to drink in the river, baptized it Thirsty. But the shipping clerk at the Howrah train station was evidently a man both befuddled and diligent. All the papers we received with the cub clearly stated that its name was Richard Parker, that the hunter's first name was Thirsty, and that his family name was none given. Father had had a good chuckle over the mix-up, and Richard Parker's name had stuck. I don't know if Thirsty None Given ever got the man-eating panther. Chapter 49. In the morning I could not move. I was pinned by weakness to the tarpaulin. Even thinking was exhausting. I applied myself to thinking straight. At length, as slow as a caravan of camels crossing a desert, some thoughts came together. The day was like the previous one, warm and overcast, the clouds low, the breeze light. That was one thought. The boat was rocking gently. That was another. I thought of sustenance for the first time. I had not had a drop to drink or a bite to eat or a minute of sleep in 3 days. Finding this obvious explanation for my weakness brought me a little strength. Richard Parker was still on board. In fact, he was directly beneath me. Incredible that such a thing should need consent to be true. But it was only after much deliberation, upon assessing various mental items and points of view, that I concluded that it was not a dream, or a delusion, or a misplaced memory, or a fancy, or any other such falsity, but a solid, true thing witnessed while in a weakened, highly agitated state. The truth of it would be confirmed as soon as I felt well enough to investigate. How I had failed to notice for 2.5 days a 450-pound Bengal tiger in a lifeboat 26 feet long was a conundrum I would have to try to crack later, when I had more energy. The feat surely made Richard Parker the largest stowaway, proportionally speaking, in the history of navigation. From tip of nose to tip of tail, he took up over 1/3 of the length of the ship he was on. You might think I lost all hope at that point. I did. And as a result, I perked up and felt much better. We see that in sports all the time, don't we? The tennis challenger starts strong, but soon loses confidence in his playing. The champion racks up the games. But in the final set, when the challenger has nothing left to lose, he becomes relaxed again, insouciant, daring. Suddenly, he's playing like the devil, and the champion must work hard to get those last points. So it was with me. To cope with the hyena seemed remotely possible. But I was so obviously outmatched by Richard Parker that it wasn't even worth worrying about. With a tiger aboard, my life was over. That being settled, Why not do something about my parched throat? I believe it was this that saved my life that morning, that I was quite literally dying of thirst. Now that the word had popped into my head, I couldn't think of anything else, as if the word itself was salty, and the more I thought of it, the worse the effect. I have heard that the hunger for air exceeds as a compelling sensation the thirst for water. Only for a few minutes, I say. After a few minutes you die and the discomfort of asphyxiation goes away, whereas thirst is a drawn-out affair. Look, Christ on the cross died of suffocation, but his only complaint was of thirst. If thirst can be so taxing that even God incarnate complains about it, imagine the effect on a regular human. It was enough to make me go raving mad. I have never known a worse physical hell than this putrid taste and pasty feeling in the mouth, this unbearable pressure at the back of the throat, this sensation that my blood was turning to a thick syrup that barely flowed. Truly, by comparison, a tiger was nothing. And so I pushed aside all thoughts of Richard Parker and fearlessly went exploring for fresh water. The divining rod in my mind dipped sharply, and a spring gushed water when I remembered that I was on a genuine regulation lifeboat, and that such a lifeboat was surely outfitted with supplies. That seemed like a perfectly reasonable proposition. What captain would fail in so elementary a way to ensure the safety of his crew? What ship-chandler would not think of making a little extra money under the noble guise of saving lives? It was settled. There was water aboard. All I had to do was find it, which meant I had to move. I made it to the middle of the boat, to the edge of the tarpaulin. It was a hard crawl. I felt I was climbing the side of a volcano, and I was about to look over the rim into a boiling cauldron of orange lava. I lay flat. I carefully brought my head over. I did not look over any more than I had to. I did not see Richard Parker. The hyena was plainly visible, though. It was back behind what was left of the zebra. It was looking at me. I was no longer afraid of it. It wasn't 10 feet away, yet my heart didn't skip a beat. Richard Parker's presence had at least that useful aspect. To be afraid of this ridiculous dog when there was a tiger about was like being afraid of splinters when trees are falling down. I became very angry at the animal. "You ugly, foul creature," I muttered. The only reason I didn't stand up and beat it off the lifeboat with a stick was lack of strength and stick, not lack of heart. Did the hyena sense something of my mastery? Did it say to itself, "Super Alpha is watching me, I better not move"? I don't know. At any rate, it didn't move. In fact, in the way it ducked its head, it seemed to want to hide from me. But it was no use hiding. It would get its just deserts soon enough. Richard Parker also explained the animal's strange behavior. Now it was clear why the hyena had confined itself to such an absurdly small space behind the zebra and why it had waited so long before killing it. It was fear of the greater beast and fear of touching the greater beast's food. The strained, temporary peace between orange juice and the hyena and my reprieve were no doubt due to the same reason. In the face of such a superior predator, all of us were prey, and normal ways of praying were affected. It seemed the presence of a tiger had saved me from a hyena. Surely a textbook example of jumping from the frying pan into the fire. But the great beast was not behaving like a great beast to such an extent that the hyena had taken liberties. Richard Parker's passivity, and for 3 long days, needed explaining. Only in 2 ways could I account for it: sedation and seasickness. Father regularly sedated a number of the animals to lessen their stress. Might he have sedated Richard Parker shortly before the ship sank? Had the shock of the shipwreck, the noises, the falling into the sea, the terrible struggle to swim to the lifeboat, increased the effect of the sedative? had seasickness taken over after that. These were the only plausible explanations I could come up with. I lost interest in the question. Only water interested me. I took stock of the lifeboat. Chapter 50. It was 3.5 feet deep, 8 feet wide, and 26 feet long exactly. I know because it was printed on one side of the side benches in black letters. It also said that the lifeboat was designed to accommodate a maximum of 32 people. Wouldn't that have been merry, sharing it with so many? Instead, we were three, and it was awfully crowded. The boat was symmetrically shaped, with rounded ends that were hard to tell apart. The stern was hinted at by a small fixed rudder, no more than a rearward extension of the keel, while the bow, except for my addition, featured a stem with the saddest, bluntest brow in boat-building history. The aluminum hull was studded with rivets and painted white. That was the outside of the lifeboat. Inside, it was not as spacious as might be expected because of the side benches and the buoyancy tanks. The side benches ran the whole length of the boat, merging at the bow and stern to form end benches that were roughly triangular in shape. The benches were the top surfaces of the sealed buoyancy tanks. The side benches were 1.5 feet wide, and the end benches were 3 feet deep. The open space of the lifeboat was thus 20 feet long and 5 feet wide. That made a territory of 100 square feet for Richard Parker. Spanning this space widthwise were 3 cross benches, including the one smashed by the zebra. These benches were 2 feet wide and were evenly spaced. They were 2 feet above the floor of the boat. The play Richard Parker had before he would knock his head against the ceiling, so to speak, if he were beneath a bench. Under the tarpaulin, he had another 12 inches of space, the distance between the gunwale, which supported the tarpaulin, and the benches, so 3 feet in all, barely enough for him to stand. The floor, consisting of narrow planks of treated wood, was flat, and the vertical sides of the buoyancy tanks were at right angles to it. So, curiously, the boat had rounded ends and rounded sides, but the interior volume was rectangular. It seems orange, such a nice Hindu color, is the color of survival, because the whole inside of the boat and the tarpaulin and the life jackets and the life buoy and the oars and most every other significant object aboard was orange. Even the plastic beadless whistles were orange. The words Simsum and Panama were printed on each side of the bow in stark black Roman capitals. The tarpaulin was made of tough, treated canvas, rough on the skin after a while. It had been unrolled to just past the middle cross bench. So one cross bench was hidden beneath the tarpaulin, in Richard Parker's den. The middle cross bench was just beyond the edge of the tarpaulin, in the open, and the third cross bench lay broken beneath the dead zebra. There were 6 oarlocks. U-shaped notches in the gunwale for holding an oar in place, and 5 oars, since I had lost one trying to push Richard Parker away. 3 oars rested on one side bench, 1 rested on the other, and 1 made up my life-saving prow. I doubted the usefulness of these oars as a means of propulsion. This lifeboat was no racing shell. It was a heavy, solid construction designed for stolid floating, not for navigating. Though I suppose that if we had been 32 to row, we could have made some headway. I did not grasp all these details, and many more, right away. They came to notice with time and as a result of necessity. I would be in the direst of dire straits, facing a bleak future, when some small thing, some detail, would transform itself and appear in my mind in a new light. It would no longer be the small thing it was before, but the most important thing in the world, the thing that would save my life. This happened time and again. How true it is that necessity is the mother of invention. How very true. Chapter 51. But that first time I had a good look at the lifeboat, I did not see the detail I wanted. The surface of the stern and side benches was continuous and unbroken, as were the sides of the buoyancy tanks. The floor lay flat against the hull. There could be no cache beneath it. It was certain. There was no locker or box or any other sort of container anywhere. Only smooth, uninterrupted orange surfaces. My estimation of captains and ship chandlers wavered. My hopes for survival flickered. My thirst remained. And what if the supplies were at the bow, beneath the tarpaulin? I turned and crawled back. I felt like a dried-out lizard. I pushed down on the tarpaulin. It was tautly stretched. If I unrolled it, I would give myself access to what supplies might be stored below. But that meant creating an opening onto Richard Parker's den. There was no question. Thirst pushed me on. I eased the oar from under the tarpaulin. I placed the life buoy around my waist. I laid the oar across the bow. I leaned over the gunwale and with my thumbs pushed from under one of the hooks the rope that held down the tarpaulin. I had a difficult time of it, but after the first hook, it was easier with the second and the third. I did the same on the other side of the stem. The tarpaulin became slack beneath my elbows. I was lying flat on it, my legs pointed towards the stern. I unrolled it a little. Immediately, I was rewarded. The bow was like the stern. It had an end bench. And upon it, just a few inches from the stem, a hasp glittered like a diamond. There was the outline of a lid. My heart began to pound. I unrolled the tarpaulin further. I peeked under. The lid was shaped like a rounded-out triangle, 3 feet wide and 2 feet deep. At that moment, I perceived an orange mass. I jerked my head back. But the orange wasn't moving and didn't look right. I looked again. It wasn't a tiger. It was a life jacket. There were a number of life jackets at the back of Richard Parker's den. A shiver went through my body. Between the life jackets, partially, as if through some leaves, I had my first unambiguous, clear-headed glimpse of Richard Parker. It was his haunches I could see, and part of his back. Tawny and striped and simply enormous. He was facing the stern, lying flat on his stomach. He was still except for the breathing motion of his sides. I blinked in disbelief at how close he was. He was right there, 2 feet beneath me. Stretching, I could have pinched his bottom. And between us there was nothing but a thin tarpaulin easily got round. God preserve me. No supplication was ever more passionate, yet more gently carried by the breath. I lay absolutely motionless. I had to have water. I brought my hand down and quietly undid the hasp. I pulled on the lid. It opened onto a locker. I have just mentioned the notions of details that become lifesavers. Here was one. The lid was hinged an inch or so from the edge of the bow bench, which meant that as the lid opened, it became a barrier that closed off the 12 inches of open space between tarpaulin and bench through which Richard Parker could get to me after pushing aside the life jackets. I opened the lid till it fell against the crosswise oar and the edge of the tarpaulin. I moved onto the stem, facing the boat, 1 foot on the edge of the open locker, the other against the lid. If Richard Parker decided to attack me from below, he would have to push on the lid. Such a push would both warn me and help me fall backwards into the water with a life buoy. If he came the other way, climbing atop the tarpaulin from astern, I was in the best position to see him early and, again, take to the water. I looked about the lifeboat. I couldn't see any sharks. I looked down between my legs. I thought I would faint for joy. The open locker glistened with shiny new things. Oh, the delight of the manufactured good, the man-made device, the created thing. That moment of material revelation brought an intensity of pleasure. a heady mix of hope, surprise, disbelief, thrill, gratitude, all crushed into one, unequaled in my life by any Christmas, birthday, wedding, Diwali, or other gift-giving occasion. I was positively giddy with happiness. My eyes immediately fell upon what I was looking for. Whether in a bottle, a tin can, or a carton, water is unmistakably packaged. On this lifeboat, the wine of life was served in pale golden cans that fit nicely in the hand. "Drinking water," said the vintage label in black letters. HP Foods Limited, with vintners. 500 milliliters were the contents. There were stacks of these cans, too many to count at a glance. With a shaking hand, I reached down and picked one up. It was cool to the touch and heavy. I shook it. The bubble of air inside made a dull glub-glub-glub sound. I was about to be delivered from my hellish thirst. My pulse raced at the thought. I only had to open the can. I paused. How would I do that? I had a can. Surely I had a can opener. I looked in the locker. There was a great quantity of things. I rummaged about. I was losing patience. Aching expectation had run its fruitful course. I had to drink now, or I would die. I could not find the desired instrument. But there was no time for useless distress. Action was needed. Could I prise it open with my fingernails? I tried. I couldn't. My teeth. It wasn't worth trying. I looked over the gunwale. The tarpaulin hooks. Short, blunt, solid. I kneeled on the bench and leaned over. Holding the can with both my hands, I sharply brought it up against a hook. A good dint. I did it again. Another dint next to the first. By dint of dinting, I managed the trick. A pearl of water appeared. I licked it off. I turned the can and banged the opposite side of the top against the hook to make another hole. I worked like a fiend. I made a larger hole. I sat back on the gunwale. I held the can up to my face. I opened my mouth. I tilted the can. My feelings can perhaps be imagined, but they can hardly be described. To the gurgling beat of my greedy throat, pure, delicious, beautiful, crystalline water flowed into my system. Liquid life it was. I drained that golden cup to the very last drop, sucking at the hole to catch any remaining moisture. I went, ah, tossed the can overboard, and got another one. I opened it the way I had the first, and its contents vanished just as quickly. That can sailed overboard too, and I opened the next one, which, shortly, also ended up in the ocean. Another can was dispatched. I drank 4 cans, 2 liters of that most exquisite nectars, before I stopped. You might think such a rapid intake of water after prolonged thirst might upset my system. Nonsense. I never felt better in my life. Why, feel my brow? My forehead was wet with fresh, clean, refreshing perspiration. Everything in me, right down to the pores of my skin, was expressing joy. A sense of well-being quickly overcame me. My mouth became moist and soft. I forgot about the back of my throat. My skin relaxed. My joints moved with greater ease. My heart began to beat like a merry drum, and blood started flowing through my veins like cars from a wedding party honking their way through town. Strength and suppleness came back to my muscles. My head became clearer. Truly, I was coming back to life from the dead. It was glorious. It was glorious. I tell you, to be drunk on alcohol is disgraceful, but to be drunk on water is noble and ecstatic. I basked in bliss and plenitude for several minutes. A certain emptiness made itself felt. I touched my belly. It was a hard and hollow cavity. Food would be nice now. A masala dosai with a coconut chutney. Even better. Uttappam. Oh, I brought my hands to my mouth. Idli. The mere thought of the word provoked a shot of pain behind my jaws and a deluge of saliva in my mouth. My right hand started twitching. It reached and nearly touched the delicious flattened balls of parboiled rice in my imagination. It sank its fingers into their steaming hot flesh. It formed a ball soaked with sauce. It brought it to my mouth. I chewed. Oh, it was exquisitely painful. I looked into the locker for food. I found cartons of Seven Oceans standard emergency ration from faraway exotic Bergen, Norway. The breakfast that was to make up for 9 missed meals, not to mention old tiffins that Mother had brought along, came in a half-kilo block, dense, solid, and vacuum-packed in silver-colored plastic that was covered with instructions in 12 languages. In English, it said the ration consisted of 18 fortified biscuits of baked wheat, animal fat, and glucose, and that no more than 6 should be eaten in a 24-hour period. Pity about the fat. But given the exceptional circumstances, the vegetarian part of me would simply pinch its nose and bear it. At the top of the block were the words, "Tear here to open," and a black arrow pointing to the edge of the plastic. The edge gave way under my fingers. 9 wax paper-wrapped rectangular bars tumbled out. I unwrapped one. It naturally broke into 2. 2 nearly square biscuits, pale in color and fragrant in smell. I bit into one. Lord, who would have thought? I never suspected. It was a secret held from me. Norwegian cuisine was the best in the world. These biscuits were amazingly good. They were savory and delicate to the palate, neither too sweet nor too salty. They broke up under the teeth with a delightful crunching sound. Mixed with saliva, they made a granular paste that was enchantment to the tongue and mouth. And when I swallowed, my stomach had only one thing to say. Hallelujah! The whole package disappeared in a few minutes, wrapping paper flying away in the wind. I considered opening another carton, but I thought better. No harm in exercising a little restraint. Actually, with 0.5 kilo of emergency ration in my stomach, I felt quite heavy. I decided I should find out what exactly was in the treasure chest before me. It was a large locker, larger than its opening. The space extended right down to the hull and ran some little ways into the side benches. I lowered my feet into the locker and sat on its edge, my back against the stem. I counted the cartons of Seven Ocean. I had eaten 1. There were 31 left. According to the instructions, each 500-gram carton was supposed to last 1 survivor 3 days. That meant I had food rations to last me 93 days. The instructions also suggested survivors restrict themselves to 0.5 liter of water every 24 hours. I counted the cans of water. There were 124. Each contained 0.5 liter, so I had water rations to last me 124 days. Never had simple arithmetic brought such a smile to my face. What else did I have? I plunged my arm eagerly into the locker and brought up one marvelous object after another. Each one, no matter what it was, soothed me. I was so sorely in need of company and comfort that the attention brought to making each one of these mass-produced goods felt like a special attention paid to me. I repeatedly mumbled, "Thank you. Thank you. Thank you." Chapter 52. After a thorough investigation, I made a complete list. 192 tablets of anti-seasickness medicine. 124 tin cans of fresh water, each containing 500 milliliters, so 62 liters in all. 32 plastic vomit bags. 31 cartons of emergency rations, 500 grams each, so 15.5 kilos in all. 16 wool blankets. 12 solar stills. 10 or so orange life jackets, each with an orange beadless whistle attached by a string. 6 morphine ampoule syringes. 6 hand flares. 5 buoyant oars. 4 rocket parachute flares. 3 tough, transparent plastic bags, each with a capacity of about 50 liters. 3 can openers. 3 graduated glass beakers for drinking. 2 boxes of waterproof matches. 2 buoyant orange smoke signals. 2 mid-size orange plastic buckets. 2 buoyant orange plastic bailing cups. 2 multi-purpose plastic containers with airtight lids. 2 yellow rectangular sponges. 2 buoyant synthetic ropes, each 50 meters long. 2 non-buoyant synthetic ropes of unspecified length, but each at least 30 meters long. 2 fishing kits with hooks, lines, and sinkers. 2 gaffs with very sharp barbed hooks. 2 sea anchors. 2 hatchets. 2 rain catchers. 2 black ink ballpoint pens. 1 nylon cargo net. 1 solid life buoy with an inner diameter of 40 centimeters and an outer diameter of 80 centimeters and an attached rope. 1 large hunting knife with a solid handle, a pointed end, and one edge a sharp blade, and the other a saw-toothed blade, attached by a long string to a ring in the locker. 1 sewing kit with straight and curving needles and strong white thread. 1 first aid kit in a waterproof plastic case. 1 signaling mirror. 1 pack of filter-tipped Chinese cigarettes. 1 large bar of dark chocolate. 1 survival manual. 1 compass. 1 notebook with 98 lined pages. 1 boy with a complete set of light clothing but for 1 lost shoe. 1 spotted hyena. 1 Bengal tiger. 1 lifeboat. 1 ocean. 1 god. I ate a quarter of the large chocolate bar. I examined one of the rain catchers. It was a device that looked like an inverted umbrella with a good-sized catchment pouch and a connecting rubber tube. I crossed my arms on the life buoy around my waist, brought my head down, and fell soundly asleep. Chapter 53. I slept all morning. I was roused by anxiety. That tide of food, water, and rest that flowed through my weakened system, bringing me a new lease on life, also brought me the strength to see how desperate my situation was. I awoke to the reality of Richard Barker. There was a tiger in the lifeboat. I could hardly believe it, yet I knew I had to. And I had to save myself. I considered jumping overboard and swimming away, but my body refused to move. I was hundreds of miles from landfall, if not over 1,000 miles. I couldn't swim such a distance, even with a life buoy. What would I eat? What would I drink? How would I keep the sharks away? How would I keep warm? How would I know which way to go? There was not a shadow of doubt about the matter. To leave the lifeboat meant certain death. But what was staying aboard? He would come at me like a typical cat, without a sound. Before I knew it, he would seize the back of my neck or my throat, and I would be pierced by fang holes. I wouldn't be able to speak. The lifeblood would flow out of me unmarked by a final utterance. Or he would kill me by clubbing me with one of his great paws, breaking my neck.
"I'm going to die,"
I blubbered through quivering